From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm April Baer.
Is escalation with Iran inevitable?
The ramifications of that are very frightening. The most vulnerable people are the ones who suffer during times of war.
Also, Congressman Fred Upton on what the U.S. should do next. Today on the show, we'll be talking with Michigan's new elections director about how he's tackling security risks for this year's balloting.
Educating local officials on the threats they might face, along with providing them some resources to help them address those threats.
The state bought millions of dollars worth of new voting machines, but is considering another tech investment. And we've got the latest on new charges in the UAW corruption scandal, plus what we learned about Michigan's economy from the GM strike. All that and more on Stateside. But first, this news. Welcome to Stateside. I'm April Baer. Today on the show, we're going to look at the new charges filed in the UAW corruption probe. Just when you think prospects can't be any more grim for the union, prosecutors start using the word racketeering. But first, more on the developing story that's dominated international attention. The path forward remains unclear for U.S. policymakers following the assassination of General Qasem Soleimani. Iran's foreign minister has been barred from traveling to the United Nations later this week. U.S. officials cited bureaucratic holdups. Meanwhile, Michigan's Congresswoman Alyssa Slotkin is preparing to introduce a war powers resolution. It would require the Trump administration to stop military actions without congressional approval. Representative Fred Upton, Republican in Michigan's 6th District, joins us now by phone. Congressman, welcome.
April, welcome.
Yesterday on the show, Senator Gary Peters told us that he does not see an easy path out of the present situation.
There is no apparent diplomatic channels that are open between the United States and Iran. And whenever you have these types of acts, that can escalate very quickly if you don't have open lines of communication. We're also in a very strained period when it comes to our relationship with our allies.
Fred, do you agree there's not an easy way out of this one?
Well, there's not an easy way. I would agree with that. We're all keeping our fingers crossed. We don't know what Iran is going to do in response to what happened this last week. My guess is, and I'm, by the way, I'm looking forward to some classified meetings later in the week, Wednesday, bipartisan meetings in both the House and the Senate. And it's my understanding that what they call the Group of Eight, and this is the senior Republican and Democrat from the Intelligence Committee, as well as the leadership, are being briefed on Tuesday, today, literally as we speak. But there's not an easy way out here. We're all waiting to see what the response may be. We're hoping that it's not too serious, but we don't know what it's going to be and where it will lead us, though it likely, unfolds as the week finishes up, concludes in just a couple of days.
We've already seen some strong reactions that affect U.S. goals in the region. For example, the Iraqi parliament has voted to expel U.S. troops. Does this killing fit into the long-term strategy to advance U.S. interests in the region?
9/11 was a day that, following that, I said I never want to be in a position to say I'm sorry we didn't do enough to prevent 9/11. Soleimani, the word is that he was preparing an imminent strike. I don't disagree. I don't know the evidence on either side, but I have to believe that it was that evidence that caused the president to make the reaction that he did, and to send the signal that you've poked the bear quite a bit here in terms of a whole number of different incidents over the last 6, 8, 10 months, and at some point the bear's going to swat back, and that's exactly what happened when he was taken out last week. Now, what, that is, those are the facts as we see them today. Where does that lead us? I don't know. I can't tell what the next couple of days are going to be. We would hope that it would be not more than a measured type of response. And the president has made pretty clear when he issued his list of, 52 different targets that we're prepared based on what Iran does or to do something else. But in the meantime, Congress needs to be brought into this, which is why we're demanding and being able to see it. It was never unexpected that we'll have some classified briefings later this week, knowing that the Gang of Eight, in fact, is being fully informed literally as we speak today.
You've been in office long enough to remember what happened after 9/11. The Bush administration's assurances that Iraq back then had WMDs and that a case for military action, ultimately war, was fully justified. That turned out to be a seriously flawed argument.
Yeah, it was.
Why trust this administration on Iran?
Well, it was flawed, and in fact, I don't think you would have had the, and I've said this before, and I was one that went to look at the evidence in the classified rooms and convinced most of the Congress that, in fact, Saddam was preparing to use chemical weapons. That proved not to be true, and had we known all of the facts back then, I think it would have been very difficult to get the votes to pass the authorization to use military force back in 2001. You know, we'll see what the evidence is, what the discussion is later this week, although I would suggest or suspect that the administration will not want to share the intimate details, at least with the rank and file members, because that may, in fact, show how they were able to assess that information and be able to block that information from becoming known, at least on the intelligence side, in the months ahead. So, we'll be all ears. I would guess that there are going to be a lot of questions from both sides of the aisle. I would suspect that both Pompeo and Esper, the Secretary of Defense, will come up and describe what they knew and what they can tell us.
Just briefly, one last question. As we mentioned, Representative Slotkin is point person on a war powers resolution we're expecting later this week. Will you vote for it?
Well, I want to see what it looks like. I would say that as part of the defense authorization bill last year, I did support an amendment with a number of other Republicans that prohibited authorization of the military force in or against Iran. We got to look at the language. I don't know what the bill is. Is this going to be a political document? Is it going to be a substantive one? Are they going to reach out to Republicans as well as Democrats, knowing, in fact, that there were a number of Republicans, like myself, that supported that amendment as part of the defense authorization bill last summer?
Fred, thanks very much for your time.
You bet. Thank you, April.
Michigan is a unique place to connect with international sentiment on what's happening in the Middle East. Yesterday on the program, we started a conversation with Shireen Smalley. She's with the National Network for Arab American Communities, based in Dearborn. But she joined us to share her personal perspective on the latest news as an Iranian American. I asked Shireen what she felt when news of the assassination broke last week.
My initial reaction was just complete horror. And also fear, and then lastly, a sense of tragedy. And I went through those emotions because for Iranian Americans, for Iraqi Americans, for those who are following or observing or understand Middle East policy and American policy, we know that this was not just the assassination of one individual, but this was really the killing of a top Iranian general in Iranian government and military, and that this would be an act that would spur some sort of retaliation. And all of that would completely close the door of diplomacy and potentially lead us to the brink of war with Iran. So really, truly an awful situation, an awful turn of events, and a tragedy for those of us who care about having peaceful relations with Iran and with other countries in the Middle East.
Have you been in touch with family members in Iran?
I have, yeah.
What are you hearing?
I'm hearing a lot of anger, a lot of fear, and a lot of just ordinarily people trying to cope. For the past few years, it's been more difficult to live in Iran and to be an Iranian. People don't have access to medicine because of the current sanctions that were reimposed by President Trump after the withdrawal from the JCPOA. The cost of foodstuff is very high. Job opportunities are scarce. And so it's difficult. Another comment that I heard from a friend of mine was that before this happened, there were more opportunities to express even opposition in terms of different opinions that may have differed from the Iranian government. However, this recent assassination has really unified the more conservative elements of Iranians' government and really quashed and stifled any future opportunity, not just for diplomacy, but for any type of sympathy with the American government or with the American people.
At a time when a foreign country makes an attack like this, people tend to circle up.
That's right. Exactly. It emboldens the more conservative and the more hardline members of any government.
Have you been in touch with people in the Persian American community around Dearborn and Detroit and Ann Arbor?
I have, yes.
What kinds of things are you hearing?
I would say that people in Iranian Americans here and Arab Americans here are afraid. They are afraid and they're waiting for the ramifications. They're waiting to see what this all means, what's going to happen. Really, what is the worst fear and what is, I would say, likely or imminent given what has happened is that there will be war in the Middle East. And that is not to the benefit of anyone. It's going to cause a lot of harm, a lot of senseless harm. And it will really hurt families, Arab families, Iraqi families, Iranian families here in Michigan, as well as those who are living in the Middle East. And again, I think the most tragic part of all of this is that it has escalated so quickly without really understanding what the reasons behind this escalation were. And so having such a senseless or being on the cusp of senseless violence and a war between these two countries and potentially being fought on the battleground of a third country, of Iraq, the ramifications of that are very frightening. The most vulnerable people are the ones who suffer during times of war, during times of conflict. And that includes ordinary Iraqis, those who have been protesting for their rights for months now. It involves Iranians. It involves those of us here who have ties to those countries. So it is a pretty heartbreaking time for Iranian Americans, for Arab Americans, for any Middle Easterner here in Michigan.
We heard Senator Peters talk yesterday about, in his view, the need for de-escalation, immediate de-escalation of the situation. Do you see a path toward unsinging this song?
Unfortunately, I don't. And that is just what has been so incomprehensible about the action that President Trump's administration took on Thursday to assassinate Soleimani. This isn't the sort of cat that you can put back in the bag. And unfortunately, those of us, even in the United States, who advocate for peace and diplomacy are going to be very hard-pressed to do so. Those in Iran who ordinarily would advocate for peace and diplomacy with the United States, it's going to be impossible for them to do that at this point.
Shireen Smalley, she works in Dearborn at the National Network for Arab American Communities. Stay with us more after a break. This is Stateside. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Prosecutors have filed a revised charge against a former United Auto Workers official. They say that Vance Pearson, a regional director in the St. Louis area, was part of an embezzlement conspiracy. This kind of charge usually leads to a plea deal, suggesting that Pearson might be ready to testify against the union's former president, Gary Jones. Detroit News Business columnist Daniel House joins us now to tell more. Daniel, welcome back to Stateside.
Thanks for having me.
Tell us a little bit more about Vance Pearson's relationship to Gary Jones. Were they close?
Yeah, he was his deputy in Region 5 for a long period of time. Gary had been running the region for about 6 years. We have pictures that appear on our website of them at golf tournaments together, and they did a lot of things together. And based on what the feds have laid out in many different filings over the last year, they worked together, putting together their big annual conference out at Palm Springs, where they were spending huge amounts of member money on cigars and golf clubs and golf clothes and fancy steak dinners and $400 bottles of Cristal champagne and Vance was in the middle of a lot of that. And we also found seen in a recent document that it appears that the federal authorities have some tape recordings of Mr. Pearson talking about some of this alleged conspiracy.
Mm. What does that mean for the government's case?
Well, I think it would probably strengthen it. What really we found very interesting about this, it was a very short filing, it was like 6 or 7 pages, was essentially the federal government alleging that Pearson and others, some of whom are identified, others who are not, although we have identified all of those in our series of stories, former President Gary Jones and his predecessor Dennis Williams, as well as about four or five other guys, were part of a criminal enterprise, and they use the word racketeering for the first time, which of course has connotations historically of organized crime. And they're making no allegations that there's organized crime involved here, but what they are suggesting is that these guys were involved in a criminal conspiracy. And as we reported in right before Christmas, this was really corruption that went from coast to coast, from the Philly area all the way to Palm Springs.
So if you are Rory Gamble, the UAW's current president right now, I'm guessing you probably want to try to keep the union from going the way of the Teamsters with years of federal oversight if that racketeering can be proved, right?
Absolutely true. In fact, in an interview I had with him right before that appeared on Thanksgiving Day, he says as much. He acknowledges for the first time that federal takeover is a real fear. It's not just a theoretical option. And one of the things that he is trying to do is institute reforms that will be essentially acknowledged by federal prosecutors and keep the wolf, as it were, from the door. They do not want federal oversight or federal monitoring, but I think based on every filing we're seeing, it's getting closer to that. The way that this U.S. attorney operates, it's very interesting. They throw little clues into some of their filings, and you have to read them closely. We had a situation of a few months back where they started talking about it wasn't just individuals at the UAW, but that the UAW itself as an institution was involved in a corrupted conspiracy. They did the same thing with Fiat Chrysler. It wasn't just some Fiat Chrysler executives, but it was Fiat Chrysler, the corporation. And if you kind of, you could easily read through some of this stuff, but there's constantly these breadcrumbs in these filings if you follow them and have the patience to do so.
Daniel, we have about a minute left. Does Rory Gamble have any cards left to play? The dissolution of Region 5 is already underway.
You know, I don't know. That's a great question. I mean, you could engage in some wholesale firings, but that's more complicated because if they're elected officers, they can't be fired necessarily. I think Matthew Schneider, the U.S. attorney, made very clear to me and my colleague Rob Snell in an interview back in November that from his perspective, they clearly were not doing enough. The dissolution of Region 5, I think, would fall in that category, and some of the other reforms are not enough. And I think one of the things that comes through to me as this unspools is that the union and its leadership still is not fully grasping the gravity of the situation that they face. This, I don't think it's too much to say that this is an existential crisis for the United Auto Workers.
Daniel House is a columnist for the Detroit News. Daniel, thanks again for checking in.
You bet.
The UAW strike against General Motors ended late last year. GM lost billions in production costs, while workers at places like Romulus Powertrain gained little.
Is it a perfect contract? No. I mean, but GM got what they wanted. We pretty much got what we wanted, and, you know, that's the best we can hope for.
The strike was traumatic for a lot of people, the longest national strike since 1970, but so much has changed in the bigger picture over those decades. Today, we're going to talk about what lessons the strike offers as we get further into 2020, things to keep in mind about Michigan's broader economy. Tracy Samilton reports on the auto industry for Michigan Radio. Hi, Tracy.
Hello.
And Charles Ballard is a professor of economics at Michigan State University. Charlie, welcome.
Thank you.
Tracy, let's start with you. What do we know about the position that the industry finds itself in right now and the damage that the strike did to the Big Three?
Well, I think we learned what we knew from past strikes. Strikes are always really damaging. They're damaging to both sides. General Motors lost $2 billion. The analysts I speak to say they may not be able to make up the lost production from that. Workers were really, really hurt. You know, they had to pull back on budgets. They weren't getting, they were getting about a quarter of what their normal pay was. It went on for weeks. A few stores maybe even had to close, but it hurt the businesses that people were, using, the workers were using. And at the end, you know, they resolved the issue, but there it was painful to get there, and we knew it was going to be painful.
Charlie, what indicators do you see of the effect that the strike had on the larger picture of Michigan's economy?
Well, the obvious one is employment, which went way down in the October jobs report, likely to go back up when we get the November jobs report. But I think really instead of focusing on the short term of the strike, I just see these in context of the longer trends of the shrinkage of the automobile industry. 50 years ago, the auto sector alone was one quarter of all the dollar value of Michigan's economy. Now it's about 8%. And then employment also has gone down, not just because of lost market share for the American companies, but also because it takes a lot fewer people now to make a car. And the jobs, instead of simple repetitive tasks in the factory of 50 years ago, the jobs in the auto sector now tend to require more skill. They often involve computer training, being able to fix robots and all that sort of stuff. So the industry has changed in ways that have not been favorable to the archetypal Michigan worker of a few generations ago, who was not necessarily well-educated, but who had two strong arms and a strong back and showed up on time.
Tracy, one of the premises of the GM strike, from a union perspective, was that times are good. You know, the past few years have been strong in terms of sales, that maybe this was the time to bargain in hopes of winning more manufacturing jobs at wages that could support families. Could the union potentially get GM and other employers to shape the next stages of production in ways that might benefit the workers? Do you see that happened?
I don't really see that happened. General Motors and Ford and Fiat Chrysler, all three of them did make product commitments for their large plants, but that's the bread and butter of any contract talks. That's the sort of expectation.
It should be baseline.
Yes.
Yeah.
And so the folks that were thinking, you know, the union rank and file who talked to me and said, you know, we want the companies to move factories from Mexico back to the U.S. To give us more of these high-paying jobs, that did not happen. And I think It's really not a surprise that didn't happen, but there are still people who want that in the rank and file.
It's hard to deny, and Charlie kind of alluded to this, the dominance of traditional vehicles, especially SUVs right now, but forecasters are saying that electric engines are where the industry is headed. Why is that of interest to the union's thinking about the future? And I mean, Charlie, you mentioned that there were fewer jobs involved in the industry. That's partly because of automation, but partly because of new trends in EVs, right?
Well, an electric motor has a whole lot fewer parts than a traditional internal combustion engine. And so the forecasts for the electrified future of the auto industry, that's another hit for employment, because it's just not going to take as many workers to put together those cars. And the union was legitimately concerned about that. Now, I would say that the union got a signing bonus, and they got some pay increases and other things. So it's not like they got nothing out of the strike, but they certainly didn't get as much as they had hoped for.
And I have to say, one of the things that they put into the contracts here is they have a joint task force with the companies now, with General Motors and I think with Ford also, on this electrification issue, because they want to make sure that what jobs there are to put together electric vehicles stay in the U.S. So they're studying this, and they're very concerned about it.
Tracy, so much of the heat and light at events like the auto shows has centered around electrics and hybrids. What signs are you seeing about whether the domestic industry is prepared in 2020 to move farther into those markets?
Well, we're told that there are, oh my goodness, General Motors alone says it's going to have 22 electric vehicles, I think by 2022, but certainly a lot of them by 20 showing up at the end of next year. Most of the automakers are telling us that they have a lot of these models coming. So right now you might have 5-6 choices for an SUV. You know, if you want a small SUV that's electric, you may not have very many. It's the most popular kind of vehicle in the US. We're being told these vehicles are on their way. They've been designed. They're ready to go. The issue, of course, is how can you get the price of these vehicles to a point where people will choose that kind of SUV over a traditional model that runs on gas.
It's been less of a problem for high-end makers, but for people who are making cars for the average buyer, it's mm-hmm. a different story.
Yeah.
Charles, can you tell us a little bit about what you think of in terms of the more positive spots in the state's economy? And if we look at the picture of diversity that we have, what is Michigan in a position to build on?
We certainly have a much more diversified economy than we had a few decades ago. That's both good and bad. The good is that we have added a lot of things. There are there's IT. There's companies like Neogen in Lansing doing biotech stuff. The chemical industry remains strong with Dow and many others. I don't see it as being one magic bullet, one big new thing that will take the place of the auto sector. Rather, I think it's going to be a whole lot of things. The healthcare sector is growing in Michigan just as it is all across the country. So I think of it as really we have opportunities in a host of areas. And frankly, for me, I don't think we should put all of our eggs into the basket of manufacturing. I want to continue. If I were in charge of Michigan, I would certainly continue with trying to diversify our economy. I don't think we can ever achieve the kind of future that I think we deserve and I hope for unless we do more investments, particularly in transportation infrastructure and also in education.
On the one hand, you know, we see targeted strategies centering on tax breaks as a main pillar of this. But is there any structural challenge in trying to bolster both where traditional strengths are located and trying to move into areas that the state would like to do more of?
Let me give you my view about the tax break strategy, which is I will admit that this is controversial. Not everybody agrees with me. But as I look at the history of handing out millions and millions and millions of dollars of tax breaks to businesses that promised that they would do stuff and often didn't deliver on those promises, I would actually prefer an economic development strategy that relies less on those things, relies more on providing the infrastructure and the educated workforce that the companies need. Tim Bartik at the Upjohn Institute has done research indicating that the majority, very large majority of projects, where they end up, they were going to end up there anyway. And the tax breaks have drained our treasury such that we have crumbling roads and a variety of other big challenges on the revenue side. And so I'm not convinced that that's been a very smart strategy. I would much rather have a kind of a broad level playing field and then also roll out the red carpet in other ways by emphasizing the quality of life that we have here.
Tracy, I believe there are going to be some projects getting underway in the new year that may rely on tax breaks. Can you give us the backstory on how tax breaks have worked out in the past? Is this something that we can point to and say, you know, this much tax incentive has actually yielded jobs for people?
Charlie was just talking about, I'm not even sure it's that controversial anymore. You know, we have the Mackinac Center for Public Policy, you know, a conservative think tank, and Upjohn, a progressive think tank, basically coming to the same conclusion on these tax breaks, which is a lot of these jobs probably were going to be created anyway. They are considered, you know, an inefficient way to stimulate the economy. So we've got Ford getting $35 million in tax incentives for two of its plants, and it says it will be creating new jobs using those funds. But the question, of course, is, would it have had to make those investments anyway? Would it have had to create those jobs anyway?
Michigan Radio's Tracy Samuelton. We've also been talking with Charles Ballard, economics professor at Michigan State University. Hey, good talking to you two. Let's make it a regular in 2020.
That would be great.
Sounds great. Thanks very much.
So you think you had some sick burns for your ex? Lynn Lee's former boyfriend blew them all away over the holidays. Lee's the owner of Lansing's Capital City Barbecue, known for its tasty banh mi and smoked chicken. In December, an outgoing message on the restaurant's phone told callers that Capital City was on extended vacation. Lee says, not true, and she believes her longtime partner in business and romance was trying to tank the place. Happily, customers were not having it. The story went viral in the Lansing State Journal and Washington Post, and Capital City was swamped with lunch orders, even having to close early one day after running out of food.
I know the community that I have never known my before, but now I know that I have so much love from the community and the love that you will never believe. How beautiful is that, and how grateful I have the love of God. He gave it to me.
Ms. Lee, thanks for proving that revenge is a dish best served on a baguette with some pickled carrots and a nice lemongrass slaw. Here's to living that best life in 2020. I do my hair talk, check my nails. Baby, how you doing? When we come back, we meet Michigan's new elections director, and he's got a full plate for 2020. Stick around. You're listening to Stateside. I'm April Bear. As crazy as election season can be, Michigan has benefited from some solid leadership over the practical aspects of voting. In 2017, Chris Thomas retired after 36 years on the job with the state, one of the most respected and experienced execs of his kind. His successor, Sally Williams, has 30 years of service under her belt before she took the job. And now, moving in is one Jonathan Brader. Talk about a rookie year. Jonathan Brader, welcome to Stateside.
Thanks very much for having me.
So I'm a little new here, too. As a first-time Michigan voter, can you tell me what you'd want me to know about the 2020 election season?
I think the most exciting thing for you to know about is that we have a brand new set of voting rights in Michigan. This will be the first federal election in which voters will enjoy the constitutional right to register to vote on Election Day at their city or township clerk's office. We have automatic voter registration when you get your driver's license or state ID card at our branches. And you can vote from home, vote by mail without giving any reason. So gone is the excuse-based absentee voting system we had in the past. We also have implemented online voter registration and several other new reforms as well. So we certainly have a high-profile election coming up, but the great news is that it's easier than ever to register and vote in Michigan.
You've been serving as legal policy director for Michigan Secretary of State Jocelyn Benson. What have you learned working in and around Michigan election issues in that way?
I have learned that we have a great team, both within the Bureau of Elections where I now, but also across the state. You know, our elections in Michigan are run primarily by our city and township clerks. We have over 1,500 city and townships in Michigan that administer elections, and our 83 county clerks also play important election functions. So we really have a deep, talented, and hardworking team of election administrators across the state. I've had the opportunity working both, you know, within the state government, but also, you know, having the opportunity to interact with and share information and knowledge with our local and county officials, that we really have a strong backbone of election administration in Michigan. So my job really is to, you know, help those who run our elections be in a position to succeed, which I expect they will in 2020 and beyond.
You know, people used to say of Chris Thomas that they couldn't guess what party he belonged to. You have worked for some progressive organizations, and Jocelyn Benson, of course, is an avowed Democrat. What would you say to people who want to know about the nonpartisan nature of the work that elections does?
Well, it really goes to what the job is. The job is to administer elections in a fair and impartial manner. It's not unlike necessarily being a judge in that sense. So whatever one's personal views are, that has no effect on the way the job is done. It's also true, I would add, of our city, township, and county election officials. Some of them have a partisan affiliation, some of them don't. But they're all required to administer elections in a fair and impartial way. And that certainly goes for myself and for all the other staff at the Bureau of Elections.
As I mentioned, this is quite the year to be stepping into a top elections job for Michigan. A brass knuckles presidential contest is underway. Voters are super nervous about the threat of hacker intervention. And also, Michigan has, as you mentioned, all these new procedural things going on. Why did you want this job?
I think that one of the really exciting opportunities was to help our state sort of move finally into the 21st century and beyond when it comes into new opportunities to register and vote. I think that the Promote the Vote constitutional amendment that was passed in 2018 really provided an opportunity for us to move really to the forefront among states when it comes to running elections. So that was one of the big draws for me to work with Secretary of State Benson and our staff here, along with our local officials, in really bringing that to voters and giving our voters the election system that they really deserve and that I believe and hope will lead to record turnout in 2020. The other really important thing for us to think about right now is this is a time when election security is paramount. And, we certainly saw in 2016 high-profile efforts to interfere with our elections. Those didn't start in 2016. They won't end in 2020 or in the near future. But we really have a lot of procedures that we're putting in place to defend against that, including expanding post-election audits, strengthening our database security, and really modernizing and across the board the systems that protect and ensure we have an accurate, fairly run election. So both of those things were really motivating.
I'm sorry to break in, but what kind of conversations are you having with the counties about limiting their risk?
Well, one thing that we've seen, in other states is that the targets can really come anywhere. So it's not necessarily going to be, if you're talking about sort of a data intrusion or a hack, it's not necessarily going to come with somebody trying to break into our system at the state level. It may be, a phishing attack that goes to a county official or a local official. It may be an effort to, what's called deface a website where you replace the information about the elections with false information. So they're very cognizant of the risks that they face as well at the local level. And a lot of our efforts have been and will continue to be on educating local officials on the threats they might face, along with providing them some resources to help them address those threats.
The state spent $82 million under previous leadership to help the counties buy new voting machines. Some news sources are reporting that you're considering replacing the modems on these machines before March. Can you explain the risk that they pose?
So a critical thing to understand about the voting machines that were purchased recently are those voting machines are not connected to the internet in any way when they are tabulating votes. The machines we use, they are optical scan tabulators, somewhat like a Scantron, that tabulate paper hand-marked ballots. So the ballots themselves are on paper. They're kept after the fact. They can be checked. The machines are not connected to the internet when they count the votes, and the official vote total is recorded without being connected to the internet. Some of these machines will then, after that, be connected to a modem temporarily to transmit the unofficial election results so that we can get basically an election night report. But that is not the official tally. The official tally is done not connected to a modem or not connected to an internet anyway. Having said that, even though the paper ballots are best practice for election security, one of the issues that we're looking at is the potential for some disruption in the connection with the unofficial results. We still don't want to see somebody have the opportunity to, in any way mess with or intercept those unofficial tallies and create some sort of confusion on election night. Again, that would not mean that the official election results were affected in any way, but we want to do everything we can to prevent any confusion or any impression that the election was not run in a fair and accurate way. So that's one of the options we're exploring with the assistance of our Election Security Advisory Commission.
Well, how much would it cost to get new 4G modems that might make that system tighter?
I don't know. I mean, it would depend on how many jurisdictions, you know, we would look at replacing them. Not all jurisdictions actually use modems. And we have three different election management systems. So the specific technology we would need to do that would probably depend on a jurisdiction by jurisdiction level. There's also just the possibility of, you know, doing it the old-fashioned way and running down with the tape to the county office, although that's easier in some parts of the state than others. So mm-hmm. I think the solution, you know, the cost would depend on what solution we end up arriving upon.
Bloomberg had that figure quoted at about $10 million for a full replacement. Does that sound about right?
Well, I think the $10 million is referring to the funding that was made available to Michigan by Congress. There was a grant of about $10 million to assist with election security infrastructure. And we're already are using some of that funding. We've hired, for example, the state's first election security specialist in the Bureau of Elections. We expect to be using some of that funding to assist our local officials in some of their security needs. But certainly we could draw upon some of that funding to address, you know, the unofficial election night reporting issues and any security concerns that might be associated with that.
Do you think it will ever be safe to connect counting machines or voting machines to the internet?
It's a very interesting question, and I think it's a question that is probably best posed to a computer scientist or a data scientist. I think, you know, the consensus right now is that that is not something that we can really rely on securely, just because of all the variables and unknowns about, you know, connectivity to the internet. I think that right now the best system is to have a paper ballot, and that's what we have. Voters in Michigan vote on hand-marked paper ballots. And the real benefit of that is that if there is a problem with a voting machine, if there is a problem with the scanners, you know, in a worst-case scenario, if someone has managed to hack into something, we can check those paper ballots, and those will tell us what the actual vote total was. And that's actually one of the major points of emphasis for us when it comes to election security in Michigan. We are expanding post-election audits so that we'll be able to check more paper ballots just to make sure that the machines counted them accurately.
Right. You mentioned the expanded audits this year. There has been a more narrow system of audits in elections past. What will this year's checks entail?
Well, what we're looking at expanding what are called risk limiting audits. That's basically quality control. You're pulling a sample of ballots off the line, and you're making sure either by comparing, you know, that ballot to the what the tabulator says, or comparing a batch of ballots and making sure that the, you know, the numbers in those ballots match up to what the total was. You're making sure that if there was some kind of major issue where the machines had counted the ballots improperly, that you would catch it. The real benefit of a risk-limiting audit is that you can count however many ballots you need to make sure that the outcome of the election was accurate. Obviously, you know, the bigger the vote total and the closer the margin, the more ballots you'd need to count. But what we've been doing is expanding these risk-limiting audit pilots, test audits, basically, after each election. And, you know, our goal is for the March primary to do a statewide pilot. So we're not going to be doing a full-on audit where we're guaranteeing that we're verifying the outcome, but we're going to do a test statewide of this risk-limiting audit after March, with the goal of then expanding it for real in the future.
The absentee no-excuse balloting that's going to be happening for this reason, do you have any projections about whether many voters will try to get in on early voting in that way?
We certainly expect a huge increase in the number of people who are voting at home, voting by mail, using no-reason AV. What we've seen, you know, in past federal elections is somewhere between 20 to 30% of people voting by mail. And in other states, when they've moved to either a vote-by-mail system or a, you know, no-excuse AV system, they have seen those numbers go up over 50% very quickly. And that's what we saw in 2019. We've seen about half of votes cast by absentee ballots in our 2019 elections. I don't know that we'll see that exact number for 2020, but I think we easily could, and we're prepared for that. So we are advising our local election officials to be ready for a big shift in the way people are voting in Michigan in terms of using the mail and voting early as opposed to going into the polling place, although that will certainly still be an option for people.
Well, speaking as a former Oregon voter, where all voting is conducted in that way, I thank you for that. And I'm sure it's going to be a big hit.
Well, we're certainly looking at other states like Oregon, like Colorado, that have moved to, you know, more voting by mail. We're certainly not Oregon at this point. We still do have polling places, traditional precincts, but we do expect to see a much higher percentage of ballots coming in by mail. And we're, of course, looking at the examples of states that have moved to that model.
Putting elections aside for a moment, do you have any role to play in the redistricting process that the Secretary of State's office has underway, responding to the voter mandate in Proposition 3?
Well, certainly the Department of State does, although once the commission is formed, it will really be an independent body. But the Secretary of State's office is charged with essentially helping that commission get set up. The Department of State sends out an application, which we've already started sending out applications for voters who want to serve on the Independent Citizens Redistricting Commission. We're going to be receiving and processing those applications throughout the year, help get the commission set up. But then at that point, there's a random draw among the qualified applicants to be on the commission. Once the commission gets set up, it's really autonomous. We can provide assistance to them if they would like us to. But really, once they get up and running in 2021, it's going to be their show.
You have pretty extensive experience in how elections are conducted. Given that experience, what do you predict will be important as the Citizen Commission gets going?
Well, I think, again, it will ultimately be up to them, but I think, they will need certainly a lot of data. I think they're going to need the expertise. It's going to need to come from somewhere in terms of, how to draw maps, what the legal requirements might be. Another really important thing, I think, for a independent redistricting process is public input. The Department of State is wants to help facilitate that to the extent possible, so that members of the public can submit their own maps. They can come to public hearings for the commission and draw what they think their community looks like and what they think should be the area of representation. I think that's critical to the success of an independent commission, because we don't. If we see an independent commission, but the only maps that are made available to them are provided by insiders, that risks having the same outcome as we've had before, which is sort of a gerrymandered insider-based process. So I think a public input and access is going to be very important.
Mr. Breiter, would you say that fears of foreign intervention are valid fears at this point?
What I would emphasize is, you hear a lot, around the country, you hear a lot of concern about, the security of our elections, the integrity of our elections. The main thing that I would really emphasize is this is an area of policy and of election administration where we really cannot afford to be divided. Certainly, people are going to have strong, valid disagreements about how our elections should be run, what our voting laws should be. But when it comes to especially, foreign efforts to interfere with our elections, a major goal of that is really to make Americans lose faith in democracy. And so what I would urge people is, if you do have concerns about the way elections are being run, don't let that stop you from participating. Certainly don't let that stop you from voting, because we do have a really dedicated, diverse group of people around the state, both at the state and local level, who really are committed to a fair, impartial, and free and accessible election process.
Well, thank you so much for talking us through this. We appreciate your time.
Sure. Thanks for having me.
Jonathan Breiter is Director of Elections for the state of Michigan. One final breaking story before we go. A group of business leaders and high-profile political leaders in Michigan have introduced a ballot initiative today that would expand the state's civil rights law to protect LGBTQ people. The story's still developing. Here to give us the latest is Michigan Public Radio's Capital Bureau Chief Rick Pluta. Hey, Rick.
Hi, April.
What would this proposal do?
Well, what it would do is Michigan's civil rights law protects people against discrimination against things like gender and marriage status. This would add LGBTQ people to that to those protected classes, that you can't discriminate based on employment and things like that.
Who's behind it?
A group of political leaders, Republicans and Democrats. No serving political leaders, though. Business groups, including Tim Cook of the Apple Corporation, DTE Energy. So national business leaders, which means that there are resources, there's money to help push this along.
Can you remind us what is entailed in the process of actually getting this to the ballot, taking it from a proposal to something people would vote on?
They have to the campaign has to gather signatures, and they're still getting the petition language together. It will be approved by a state elections board. If they gather, it's 400 and something thousand signatures of registered voters. It goes to this elections board, and then if it's approved, it goes to the legislature. The legislature can then adopt it, and it becomes law. No governor's signature necessary. It is veto-proof. If it's rejected or ignored, it goes to the ballot. And, well, we can turn to Trevor Thomas with Fair and Equal Michigan to explain the rest.
It is time that if the legislature does not move forward, we hold folks accountable and be able to take this to the voters to finally get this done once or for all.
Right. So at that point, it goes to voters. If it's adopted, it becomes law. And if it's not, well, it doesn't.
Michigan Public Radio's Rick Pluta. Rick, thanks very much.
Oh, pleasure.
We'll have a lot more on the ballot initiative coming up tomorrow on Stateside. I'm April Baer from all of us here at Michigan Radio. Thanks for listening. We'll catch you tomorrow.